Welcome to another episode of My Wake Up Call. This is the podcast where I find out a little bit about my guests, and I want to save getting to know them for the podcast because you, our listeners and viewers, when these get posted as videos, seem to want to find out about them. I've been tracking this guy down for a while, and I'm so glad to have Chris Voss on the show. I will say to you, what are the words negotiation and Chris Voss have in common? And they're synonymous. They're interchangeable. And he has the top masterclass of all masterclasses. You know, forget Simon Sinek, forget Bob Iger, forget some of these other people.
Don't forget Bob Iger. Bob Iger is a very sharp dude, and pay attention to him.
He's very sharp. And I think part of it, and you're going to catch this, is there's something incredibly accessible and likable about Chris, and he's so practical, and his stories are amazing. But let me tell you a little bit about him. He's the CEO and founder of the Black Swan Group, and he's the author of Never Split the Difference: Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. And check it out on Amazon. It's phenomenal. Has thousands and thousands of reviews. And as I mentioned, he has the number one course at Masterclass called The Art of Negotiation. He's used many years of experience in international crisis and high stakes negotiations to develop his unique approach and his team to apply these globally proven techniques to the business world. And he and I are members of an entrepreneurial group that meets on Saturday, and he blesses us every 6 weeks or so. He comes on and he just drops these hidden in plain sight nuggets where you think, I never would have thought of that. And it's just there. If you just do it, it works all the time. Prior to 2008, he was the lead international kidnapping negotiator for the FBI, as well as the FBI's hostage negotiation representative for the National Security Council's Hostage Working Group. During his government career, he's also presented to the U.S. government at two international conferences. And prior to becoming the FBI lead international kidnapping negotiator, Chris served as the lead crisis negotiator for the New York City division of the FBI. And he was a member of the New York City Joint Terrorist Task Force for 14 years. And there's just so much more and more, but I want to save time so that Chris can find his way to be on this freaking podcast. So, Chris, thank you for joining us.
Mark, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate knowing you.
Well, it's the honor is all mine. But I will hit you up with what I ask all my guests. You know, if you were to step back and think of some consistent through line in your life, I remember I had Tim Brown on. He's the chair of IDEO, and he liked the podcast because he's always focused on design and technology, and I shared with him a quote that I got from a mentor of mine, a guy named Warren Bennis, and I said, Tim, you're a first-class noticer. And he said, what's that? I said, noticing is different than looking, watching, and seeing. Looking, watching, and seeing, you're passive, but you notice stuff. I mean, so getting back to the question of the through line, what is it that you've noticed through your life that grabbed your attention and landed you in what you're doing?
Yeah, great question. You really got me thinking, and maybe two different things. I mean, the first one is, you know, I like figuring stuff out. My father had a very figured out attitude, his approach to life, and then growing up in under my father's roof, I mean, he expected his kids to work and to figure things out. So I think it was, and I had no choice. Like, you know, my older sister and I, my dad wanted a new garage. We had an old garage in the backyard. He handed us crowbars and said, go figure out how to tear the old garage down. I think it was about 11 or 12 years old at the time. So
What
But
was it?
I've always enjoyed figuring things out, and I think that's the biggest piece.
Did you go through a phase because, I'm now seeing my grandchildren and, kids can be a little bit ornery. Did you go through a phase where you said, figure it out, where you push back a little bit, but then as soon as you got into it, you got the self-satisfaction. Hey, it's pretty neat figuring stuff out. You feel pretty independent. Was there a rebellious streak in you at all?
Yeah, and everybody has one at some point in time, and it manifests itself in different ways. So no, I didn't. I was never openly rebellious. There was a period of time when I was about 18 years old that I literally, my father never struck me the way, a man would strike another man. He spanked me when I was little, not a whole bunch of times, but when I got to be more his size, he never struck me, and I made him angry enough. For good reason, when I was 18, that I was sure that he was going to pummel me. But
What happened? What happened?
I just became at the summer between my senior year in high school and my freshman year in college, I became just useless, just completely apathetic. He sent me out on tasks, and I would do a horrible job. I was utterly useless. And he at some point in time, he's paying me. He's not paying me to be useless. I remember he had enough, and he had, in his business where his office was in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. I remember him taking me in the alley behind the office and beginning to completely lose his cool at me. And I was certain that, and I knew my father was very good with his hands. I never saw firsthand, but I knew stories of him brawling when he was in the Marines. I was certain he was going to pummel me, and he did not, but he did get my attention.
Do you think you didn't you respected him, didn't you?
Yes.
And do you think that part of and I'm a shrink, I dissect some of these things. Do you think that part of it was thinking, geez,
Are
not
you charging me for this session?
a, no,
Am I going to have to pay for this?
no,
I'm on a
but.
couch right now, right?
But I'm seeing a situation. He takes you back there. He's about to lose it. He's really pissed off at you. But if I'm Chris at 18, I'm thinking, geez, I really disappointed this guy that I respect.
Yeah, well, there's a fair amount of cognitive thought there that sometimes 18-year-olds in the midst of all their hormone changes and growth can't really connect the dots at the time. I'm not sure that I was bright enough at the time for that to occur to me. It did get my attention.
Yeah.
I straightened up right away. I remember the very next day, he found out that I did something right, and he drove 30 miles to congratulate me.
Wow.
And then I think I slowly straightened out my act. I mean, later that fall, I actually went out of my way to help him out on something that I knew he was having a real problem with, and I knew he appreciated that. So I think it sunk into my subconscious, if not my conscious, that I disappointed a man that I respected and I needed to straighten up.
Yeah. I've been blessed. I've had eight mentors. They've all died. The last one was Larry King and a guy named Warren Bennis before him. And
An impressive list.
I was very fortunate. And but they I'll tell you, not disappointing them was the top of my list. I would never tell them I was ever going to do something unless I was 150% sure I was going to do it. And because their esteem for me was amazing. When you get someone to think that, hey, you might be kind of special in this way, there was nothing as good as that. And my father, my brothers and I, we had sort of a troubled relationship, so I think that's one of the reasons I sought out mentors and things like that. But get us back to you. You're the guest there. So you straighten out your life and then take us from there. And what came to be important to you as you started to straighten out and get on with your life?
Well, I think, doing the right thing. That sounds like a cliche, but it's always been something that resonated with me. And, you know, despite all the stupid stuff that I did, you know, through my late teens, early, mid-20s, like really stupid stuff. And we never stopped doing stupid stuff, of course, but,
Can you just serve up one of those? Because see, one of the challenges my audience has is, God, you have guests and they're just perfect. I mean, I can't do what they do because they're just perfect. I'm just some guy listening in or some woman listening in. And so the more that people can humanize themselves with a little bit of a humor. So can you share one of the, and I'll match you stupid and foolish for stupid and foolish. Trust me.
Yeah. You know, and that's a great point to bring up too, because that myth needs to be pierced. I mean, Ferris's book, Tools of the Titans, I think that I was looking at several years ago. One of my big takeaway early on was he said, like, all successful people have deep flaws. Like, there ain't nothing out there. There is no such thing as an unflawed human being. Probably no such thing as someone who's not deeply flawed. And all of your heroes and all of your idols are the same. They got real serious flaws. And so, yeah, that's, you know, just, you know, growing up in Iowa, I grew up as fairly goody two shoes. Like, the worst thing I ever did was drink beer illegally in a cornfield, or drink, you know, drinking age in Iowa when I was growing up was 18. And I turned 18 when I was still in high school with it. You know, I mean, even drinking and driving at all, I never got arrested for drunk driving, only by the grace of God. And which is why when a judge, and somebody is arrested for drunk driving, a judge realized that ain't the first time this person was drunk driving. You know, thank God for Uber and Lyft, because they're, you know, they're no excuse for getting behind a wheel with any alcohol in your system now. And which is a rule that I pretty much stick to. I can't remember. I don't think I'm breaking that anymore. But I did, you know, and I was lucky enough that I never got arrested for it. And I never got into an accident when I was drinking. Grace of God only. And mostly stuff along those lines, because I was, you know, in Iowa, in the environment that I grew up in, like, the worst thing, I didn't smoke marijuana when I left high school. I wouldn't even talk to people that smoked marijuana. And I got to college and there were people that I thought were really cool. And I'd be in a gathering and somebody would break out a joint and I'd be like, what? I thought you were cool. How dare you drink this or smoke this illegal substance? And then I didn't know how to refuse it. I was afraid to be around people that were refusing it. And I'm sitting around in my fraternity one night on the roof, bunch of guys drinking, and then they started passing around a joint and they went to hand it to another guy in the fraternity that I really held a lot of esteem for. And he just went, no, thanks. And nothing bad happened to him. And I thought, wow, if it's that easy just to say, just to refuse if you don't want it. Not succumb to peer pressure. So, but you know, I struggled with my life like everybody else did.
So you just happened upon that example where you said, gee, that's pretty simple. Just say no thanks. Because if you're not familiar with Chris's work or Never Split the Difference, he comes up with these responses to almost any situation that are what I call hidden in plain sight, brilliant. I never would have thought of that, and I think that would work. So can you share a little bit how that evolved? Because you are a master. I've watched you. People could hit you up with any question, and you seem to have a counterintuitive, I never would have thought of that kind of response. It's almost like you're almost an artist in the way that you do that.
That's very kind. I think my first approach is, first of all, you know, I don't care what works. I just want to know what works. Like, and you were talking about Larry King being curious, you know, when you and I were talking earlier before, and curiosity is a superpower. And like, I just want to know what works. If I got to figure it out, like, you know, what works. And, you know, nobody figures stuff out without somebody spurring the thought in their head. Like, they either see it done, or in many cases, when we're teaching a black swan method, we won't give you the answer to a question until we burn the question in your brain. And we got an extremely intense negotiation exercise we put people through. extremely intense, called 60 Seconds So She Dies. We don't tell you how to deal with it until we, you know, until you feel like you've theoretically been beaten with a baseball bat, having gone through it. And then afterwards, we start laying out how to handle a high pressure, high intensity negotiation. And sometimes people say, well, you know, why the heck didn't you teach me that before you put me through the exercise? Well, you wouldn't have hung on to it until you understood that you had a problem that you needed solving. And so I think probably that smoking marijuana instance back, you know, when it was a horrible thing to do, you could go to jail for serious time for even being in possession of marijuana back in those days, right or wrong. I ain't saying it's right or wrong. It's the way it was. Like, I didn't know how to refuse just and not be ridiculed or embarrassed. I mean, I'm up in my head, my amygdala, which I know you're well familiar with what that amygdala does to you. You know, my amygdala is whispering in my ear, just like it does everybody else's. And then I see this guy just go, no, no, thanks. And everybody was cool. And I needed to see somebody do it. I knew I'd been struggling with it. Somebody did it. I was like, wow, that's all there is to that? Wow, okay. You know, it didn't look that hard.
So can you share a few nuggets to whet people's appetites, that some of the things that you've observed, you've learned, you've taught, that when people hear it, they'd say, that's not so hard, and that would work. You know, so to build on what you just said, I focus on what works. You know, I'm not trying to be some super intellectual academic type. I look at a situation, it's got a problem, what's going to work to fix it? So can you share a few examples that when people discover them, they just smile in disbelief, like, oh my God, it's so simple.
Well, yeah, the opening story, Never Split the Difference, revolves around the phrase, how am I supposed to do that? And when somebody has given you a challenge that either is ridiculously difficult for you or you just can't do. Like, how do you not refuse, but how do you begin to telegraph to them that this is going to be a problem? Or how do you get them to maybe change your perspective? Like, and the response is not, I can't do that. The first response is, how am I supposed to do that? And that is like transformatively effective for people negotiating with difficult situations. Now, the downside of it is, like, 8 out of 10 times, you get a 180-degree turn in the situation. Now, 1 in 10, you know, I would say 2 in 10 to be generous, but 1 in 10 maybe. It doesn't work, which you get, and people that are so used to that being a home run will get back to us and say, how am I supposed to do that fail? And we say, no, it didn't fail. It just gave you a different picture of what's going on. The 1 in 10 times that somebody turns right back on you and says, that's your problem. I don't care what happens to you. That's your problem. People are so flummoxed by that, they said, this failed. Well, it didn't fail. What happened was you got feedback that was different than what you expected. With that feedback, the person just blatantly told you they do not care about you in any way, shape, or form, which now you got a second decision to make. Do I want to continue? Is this a business partner? Is this a colleague? Is this a kidnapper? Is this a proverbial terrorist? But you now know what you're dealing with. And in our business and our personal life, the real answer there is move on. As hard as it is, this is a, you know, who wants to stay in a business or personal relationship with somebody that doesn't care about you? But how am I supposed to do that? I learned that question from a Pittsburgh drug dealer.
Well, share that story a little bit quickly.
Well, we had a kidnapping in the Philippines that had gone really bad right after a really successful one. The very next one was a train wreck, the Burnham Sabero case. 2 out of 3 of the Americans ended up dead. A bunch of Filipinos ended up dead. And in the midst of it, I knew that someone had acquired proof of life by getting one of our hostages on the phone. And to me, that was magic. Like, we'd love to get proof of life, but we never got a hostage on the phone. So what the heck is going on if somebody else got a hostage on the phone? And not only that, who's doing that? There are multiple buyers for the same hostage. This is supposed to be a buyer's market. That's supposed to be a bidding war. And it flummoxed me. Never got the answer in the case. And then there's a drug dealer and drug dealer kidnapping in Pittsburgh. A few months later, one drug dealer grabs another drug dealer's girlfriend. Now, in the United States, when somebody in your family gets kidnapped, no matter what your op occupation is, you're probably going to the FBI. So this drug dealer went to the FBI in Pittsburgh. Help. So FBI hostage negotiators are riding around in the victim drug dealer's car, taping the conversations with the bad guy drug dealer, which I realize is a redundant term. But out of the blue, the victim drug dealer just asks a fair, natural question. And he says, I'll never forget the words, "Hey, dog, how do I know she's all right?" The how question. And there's this long silence on the other end of the line. And a drug dealer says, "I'll put her on the phone." And that's when I went like, wow. It took, somebody like this. This was eating at me. I didn't know the answer. And somebody in a very practical situation who was not a sophisticated FBI hostage negotiator just asked the natural and normal question that the other side has got to allow you to ask. They may not like, you may not like the way that you answer it, but this is a legit question. We started using various forms of how with every bad guy that you can imagine on Earth. And it never made things worse. And 9 out of 10 times, it made things exponentially better. At worst, they always said, "That's your problem." That's actually not an escalation. And it's, since it's more information, you're better off, but it never made things worse.
What do you think that is fascinating. What do you think goes on in someone's mind, and you're locked in a transactional zero-sum game in which it feels like everyone's going to lose. What do you think goes on in someone's mind when you add to the conversation how?
Yeah, well, I mean, as long as you don't say it in an accusatory fashion, like you think they're an idiot, tone, as I know, as you know, because you got a great natural tone of voice, and you got a nice, calming, downward inflecting voice, which is, a great, great, phenomenal tone of voice to get away with saying almost anything. So, with a great tone of voice, and how by definition is. People love to be asked how, so they feel good to be asked how. It makes them, it empowers them. On some level, they feel that you're asking for help. You're seeking help, that you're asking them to take a look at your position and to think about it. Danny Kahneman would say it triggers in-depth thinking, slow thinking. So it starts working on people on a whole number of levels. And it's really asked for the effect, not the answer. The answer's bonus points. But to ask somebody how, it's a stop and think question, which always plays to your advantage if you're on the other end of that.
Wow, I'll share something with you. It's a tangent, but hopefully it's okay. Before the pandemic, I had a partner, and we were starting a movement, and the movement was called "What Made You Smile Today?" And the idea is that whenever someone serves you, a TSA agent, a cashier at Costco, McDonald's, they have a name tag, but they're faceless. They're an appliance, and they're treated like appliances. And so
Interesting, yeah.
the whole idea, and I did this with 1,000 people. I spoke in Russia along with Danny Kahneman. I mean, the three of us spoke, and he would.
Wow.
My book behind me was a bestseller in Russia. And but the way "What Made You Smile" works, and I'm just thinking of what you said, is that, and we're encouraging people to do it. So if someone serves you, you look at their name tag. And you say, "Hey, Nancy, my name's Chris. Thank you," which they often don't get, and they sort of awkward. And you look at them, and you could say, "I have a question for you," and they get nervous. And you say, "No, you're not in any trouble." And you say, "What made you smile today?" And Again, it's like your track record with the how thing. It's not 100%, but 90% of the time they'll pause. They will look up at the ceiling because they're thinking, because no one ever asked them that. And then when they come down, there's a smile in their eyes saying, my dog, my kid, my such and such. And the whole conversation has transitioned out of being transactional. I did it at McDonald's a couple months ago, and there weren't any other customers there. And when I asked Maria, and she said what made her smile, I'm there having my coffee, and there was no one there. She just kept smiling at me. I got so uncomfortable, I had to leave. But it reminded me of it when you said that, when you can say how or do things that cause people to pause and then look up in their mind, it breaks the transactional logjam. So
Yeah,
thank
nice
you.
stuff. I like it. I'm gonna test drive that baby. That's a good idea. I love it.
Yeah, well, I'll send you a video because there was this startup of young kids in Manhattan, and they did a video of this. They said, we're going to try this in Manhattan. And they went to shopkeepers, and they were so uptight. I mean, they videoed themselves. I'm really nervous. I'm here surrounded by people in New York. And but we told the doc we were going to try it, and I'll send you the video. And they started asking people, and they videoed it. And people, shopkeepers, a number of them Hispanic, got kind of shy. One of them came out and started dancing with them. It was crazy.
Wow.
It was crazy. I'll send it to you because I think it'll make you smile.
Making the world a better place, too.
Well, we're all trying to do that. So, anything that you can whet our appetite on that you're moving towards in the next year or two, or is it just getting the message out and refining your method and growing Black Swan Group? Or what does the future for Chris Voss look like?
Well, there's blessed that there's several projects in the works. There's a documentary on sort of my career journey from FBI hostage negotiator to business advisor, and then back to how we're trying to help solve back into police minority community problems. We're my son Brandon is very big in that area. Did some training for NYPD. That documentary is going to be premiered in LA, September 26th of this year. I'm not sure when a podcast will come out. We got a couple of follow-on books, and we got another project with Masterclass going to put out some more stuff. So, and just continuing to get better at the Black Swan method. We learned something. There's something every single year that we find ourselves using it to solve in business and personal conversations that we weren't even aware of a year before. So I think that's really cool. We're just continuing to build the method.
Give us an example of one of those new things in the last year or two that you discovered that never came to you before.
Yeah, well, I'll talk about it. It's a hostage negotiation technique, and I know it's a therapy technique that you're well versed in. It's called the I message. It's a three-part message. The way we construct it is when you X name a behavior, I feel X, name sadness, uncertainty, concern, basically a mild version of a negative emotion, negative impact, anger. You don't never want to say I feel angry because you're going to trigger other things. Because, and then the because is really critically important. And in a business context, the because has got to cost the other side. Now, it could cost you also, but it can't just be a cost to you. Like we had one consultant tell a client, want to tell a client, when you cancel on me with only 2 days' notice, I feel concerned because it costs me 2 days of revenue and it disrupts my calendar. Now, that's wrong on a third part. Because the cost was only to the consultant. And the other side already disregarded that cost. So the corrected version is when you cancel on me 2 days in advance, I feel concerned because it's going to stop me from being able to book with you again. Now it's across to the other side. And we started to apply this consistent business problems in our scope group. Now, in the therapeutic world, you're trying to counsel somebody who's screaming at you, calling you names, failing to show up for appointments, negative behavior that's impacting your ability to help them become better people. In the business world, business counterparts on scope creep are asking for free things after you made the deal. And one of our salespeople said, when you continue to ask for free things after we've already come to agreement, I feel concerned because it's going to stop us from having a healthy business relationship. Now, as you know, an I message is not going to guarantee the other side is going to change their behavior. It's just your best shot at it. You're going to deploy an I message and you're going to give them a chance to become aware and decide whether or not to adjust the behavior or to choose to not care even more. And in this, not everybody's going to stop scope creep with a good I message. This particular client went, oh, okay. Because they've been taught to continue to ask for free stuff. It had always worked, had been oblivious to the damage it was doing to business relationships, and needed to be told in a way that wasn't insulting, which is, again, the point, as you well know, of an I message is not to back somebody into a corner, separate it from their behavior, show them that the behavior is negative. And if properly shown, not everybody's going to turn themselves around. But if they're going to, you need to do it in a way that's non-judgmental, not a personal insult, and doesn't escalate. And then they get the choice as to whether or not to fix. And we've really only been doing this over the last year because we walk our talk. All of our business development people use our negotiations skills with people who expect to be negotiated with because of who they're talking to.
That's great. Can I share a little widget with you? A cycle. It's not negotiation, but a friend of mine taught me this, and I've been teaching it to startup companies, and it might be a good exercise for your people. So, can I share something with you that I've been teaching it to people at Metal.
Please do.
When someone asks you, "What do you do?" When you say I do, they've already heard enough.
Ah, interesting.
Because even though they've teed it up, what do you do? I do. Oh, here it comes. And so this person, a dynamic woman named Alicia Dunham, she said, when people ask you, what do you do? You don't use the I, you don't say I do this. You could say companies hire or bring us in when. In order to so that.
Ah.
So the idea is you want to create urgency. What do you do? And you want to plant in their mind something parallel because you'd like them to hire you. Well, companies hire or bring in the Black Swan group when they've really either missed out on some big deals they could have had, or they have a big deal coming their way that they don't want to lose. So that they don't have to go through the brain damage internally of how do we screw this thing up? Wait, so that in order to be able to correct these kinds of things which can create a lot of brain damage in the organization. So it's the when is urgency? So people are comparing themselves to you. They hire us when. So that is the feature. In order to is the benefit. And it just works nicer than saying, I do, we do such and such, because even though they're asking you the question, so many people are just scared, like, okay, here it comes. Here comes the sales pitch. But if you say, oh, people hire us when such and such, so that they can accomplish this in
That's
order.
brilliant, brother. I love that.
I thought
That's
you
a
might like
great tool, man.
Yeah, I want to share that with you. So thank you for the gift of your time, and I've been so looking forward to spending time with you because I'm one of your biggest fans, and in fact my son goes to he goes to Harvard Law School, and I said, "Were you taught negotiation?" Yeah, and I said, "So do they use Never Split the Difference?" And it's a course, Getting to Yes by Urey and Fisher. I said, boy, they're backwards there. So I'm going to turn him on to what you have to offer because
Thank you.
love your stuff, love your stuff. So the best way and best place for people to find and get more of you is what?
Yeah, it's really to subscribe to the weekly, concise, complimentary blog slash newsletter that we put out. You know, complimentary. I had a friend in the FBI used to like to say, if it's free, I'll take three. But, you know, if it's not actionable and concise, it wastes your time. So comes out on Tuesday mornings. Send a text message to the number 33777, 33777. The text message to send to that number is Black Swan Method, three words, lowercase, spaces between the words. You'll get a text response back to sign up for the newsletter. The newsletter is a gateway to everything we have, training, you know, product announcements, course announcements. When they're in there, but there's always an actionable and concise article on negotiations Tuesday morning after you get Monday behind you, kind of tease up your week to negotiate effectively. Newsletter is the best way to keep up with us.
I get it every Tuesday. That's what has reminded me to have you on. You
Thanks.
know, something I want to, another compliment I want to give Chris is, and why you should get the newsletter. I don't think that there are few things that people can't stand more than having someone waste their time. And sign up for his newsletter, check out what he's doing. It is so practical, and you don't have to be, you just have to be curious and interested. You don't have to be a genius to have it work for you. So please, if you're a supporter of this podcast, I am asking you to support what Chris is doing,
Thank you, Mark.
not for his sake, but for your sake, listeners. So until next time,
Amen.
thank you, Chris, for being on. Thank you, listeners, and thanks for supporting the podcast. And until next time, when wake-up calls come your way, they're there to wake you up. So wake up already.